Welcome to the beginning of our Fall Public Events series. My name is Howard Burton. I'm Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's truly a wonder and a joy to have so many people here to start off the series. I think given the subject matter of this evening, it's important to be punctual, so I'm glad we all made it here on time. A little bit before I introduce our speaker for this evening, I would like to also point out that in keeping with our event series of last year, we will be having two other events in the fall term, again on the first Wednesday of every month. So November 5th, there will be a panel discussion on Canada's international scientific reputation. And then on December, I can't actually remember, the first Wednesday of December, I think it's the third, Dr. John Casti will be giving a talk on the limits of scientific knowledge. But tonight, it is a privilege and a pleasure to be able to introduce our speaker, Dr. Faye Dowker. Faye is joining us for a year at Perimeter Institute from Imperial College. She began her more advanced scientific training as a graduate student of Stephen Hawking in Cambridge and went on to do postdoctoral fellowships at Fermilab, at Caltech, and at Santa Barbara before faculty position at Queen Mary College before moving on to Imperial College. She is an extraordinarily broad and gifted scientist with a wide variety of interests ranging from black holes, wormholes, gions, and the like, and now she is a formative researcher in quantum gravity with a related passion for foundational issues in quantum theory. Not only is Faye a very broad scientist, she's a very broad person as well, and I don't know if she wants me to talk about this, but she's involved in an artistic collaboration in London, England, where I don't know if I can speak about it at great length, but it involves an artistic simulation, if you will, of some of the wonders of quantum mechanics. So I don't know if Faye can talk about that later if she sees fit. And right now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Dr. Faye Dowker.
Nothing is more fundamental to our experience of the world than that we have those experiences in time. We are aware of time passing and can hardly make sense of our lives except in the context of a fixed past of events that have occurred and can never be changed, and a future of as yet unrealized potentialities, with a mysterious, tantalizing, and elusive moment of now. The marvelous moment, the now of our conscious experience, which divides the two. I call the present moment elusive, partly because it never sits still. Whenever one tries to hold a moment in one's mind, it has already slipped by and become the past. Time is inexorable. It will not stop, as Kyle said about the Terminator. No matter what we do, tomorrow will come. As I was preparing this lecture, I was, of course, acutely aware that the moment would come when I would have to present it. And indeed, here it is. Tomorrow morning when you wake up, you will remember that I said, yes, time is inexorable, tomorrow will happen. And tomorrow morning you'll wake up and say, yes, indeed, here it is. Can we understand time? Can we understand these properties that it seems to us to have? Can we study it? Throughout history, it has mostly been philosophers who have considered the question of the nature of time. But the way we know and understand the world should depend on the best theories that we have of it. And so our understanding of time itself cannot be independent of our best science. Now, we happen to be both very lucky and very unlucky in our attempt to understand time scientifically. Lucky because one of our very best theories happens to say a lot about time, about the nature of time. But we're unlucky because what it has to say turns out to be at odds with our perception of time. Indeed, that theory denies the reality of our experience and sets up an alternative picture of reality in which there is no now at all, no flow of time. It suggests that what we experience is merely an illusion. The theory in which this extraordinary conclusion is reached is Einstein's theory of gravity called general relativity. And I want to spend quite a bit of time in my talk describing it to you and explaining just how strong a conclusion this is. So this is the plan of my talk this evening. I'll first describe the scientific scene vis-a-vis time before general relativity was developed. That is the view of time held in the past, before Einstein. In a sense, the view of time held then, that time is universal, is what we still have as the so-called common sense view. So it's important to understand what it is and why we hold it and how it could be wrong. The view that replaced it, and which is our current best scientific understanding of time, is what I will describe in the second and longest part of the talk, time in the present. I will take some care introducing the concept that is central to that understanding, and that concept is space-time. I want to make you feel at home with space-time, as much at home as I can, because in a very real sense, space-time is our home. We act out our lives in space-time, and if all the world's a stage, then the structure of that stage is the structure of space-time. I'll explain why this modern view of reality is at odds with our perception of the passage of time. Then finally, I'll explain why, in a theory of space-time that incorporates the principles of quantum mechanics, in a so-called quantum theory of gravity, there seems to be hope that we might be able to recover the flow of time as a real phenomenon, and that would be time in the future. Up until the beginning of the last century, our best theories in physics were Newtonian mechanics, Newton's theory of universal gravitation, and the theory of electromagnetism due to Faraday and Maxwell. The view of space and time in which these theories were embedded was the Newtonian, or also called the Galilean view, that space is like a fixed block of something, say perfectly invisible and weightless glass that stretches out to infinity in all of three dimensions. Time is very different from space. Time is universal in this view, and the same at every position in space. There is, in effect, a big clock in the sky that ticks away at the same rate for everyone and everything in the universe, wherever it is and whatever it's doing. In this view, it makes sense to say things like, at this precise moment in Paris, most people are asleep. Because there is such a thing as this precise moment in Paris, which is synchronized exactly with now here in Waterloo. Why did this come to be the dominant scientific view of space and time? And why is it still what might be called the common sense view? After all, a priori, there's no reason to assume that time is the same here as at some other place in the universe. If we were somehow confined to Waterloo and could never leave, and no one from the outside could ever get to Waterloo, and suppose we'd all just been born here and had never ever gone anywhere else, there would be no reason at all for us to assume that time behaved in the same way, flowed at the same rate as time does here. First, note that the statement that time is the same everywhere in space does not mean that it is the same time in the sense that we often use the phrase in everyday language. There are time zones, of course, and 12 p.m. here in Waterloo corresponds to 6 p.m. in Paris. That doesn't mean that we believe that time itself is behaving differently in these places. It is just a convention. What we mean by saying that time is the same in Waterloo and Paris is that the duration of a second is the same in each place. Even though we've chosen for convenience to give different clock labels to a particular universal moment now. We believe that the clocks in Canada and the clocks in France keep exactly in step with each other, so that when it's 12:01 p.m. in Waterloo, it's 6:01 p.m. in Paris, etc. In the same way, when we adjust the clocks back an hour at the fall solstice, we don't believe that time itself is going backwards. Time itself, with a capital T and a capital I, carries on regardless, ticking away to itself inexorably and with perfect regularity, no matter what we set our clocks to read or wherever we are. So what I've just described was the dominant scientific view until 1900, and it's still the so-called common sense view that we have today and which we use to organize our lives with. Why is this? What is the evidence for it? The evidence on which we all, very sensibly and very scientifically, I would say, base our common sense view is the accumulation of many, many observations of the following sort. Suppose two of us here have stopwatches, and let's use stopwatches to get around the problem of time zones, complications like time zones. And suppose the two of us with our stopwatches go about our business. Maybe one travels around the world a little bit, and one of us stays here and potters about. Then if we meet back up later, somewhere, we agree to meet at some place later, and we compare the times on our stopwatches, then the times that have passed for each of us are exactly the same. The same amount of time has passed for me as has for you. This will be true no matter how far we went, where we went, how long the journey was, whether it took a few minutes, hours, or days. In each of our lifetimes, we've all made observations of this sort on thousands of occasions. We make the assumption that time flows at a universal rate for everyone everywhere, and we never go wrong. We never turn up at the wrong time for an appointment. We are always on time for meetings. Stock markets open and close on schedule, and the trains always run on time. As for scientists, using this assumption in their experiments, up until the beginning of the 1900s, they didn't find any discrepancies either. So it's perfectly logical and scientific to assume that time is universal. But can you imagine how differently we would think about time if our everyday observations were different from this? Imagine a world where, when two people synchronize their watches and go off doing different things and then meet up later, their watches showed that different amounts of time had passed for them. And this happened constantly with perfectly good watches that were in perfect working order. We would no longer say that when it's 12 p.m. in Waterloo, it's 6 p.m. in Paris. It would make no sense because for the one basic reason that all the watches here in Waterloo would all read different times, depending on what the wearer was doing and where they were going. Life would be pretty complicated to organize. But having grown up like that, if we lived in such a world, it would not be surprising to us. It might be awkward, but it would seem perfectly natural. And being the inquisitive creatures we are, we'd want to try and figure out why and by how much the times measured by two different watches on different journeys differ. We would start asking questions like, does it depend on where you go? Does it depend on how you travel? And we would do experiments, send someone to Paris and back on an airplane, send them to Paris and back on a boat, send someone to Santiago, send them to Mount Everest, send them down a mine, send them to the North Pole or to Alpha Centauri and back and compare how the readings on their stopwatches differ. After all, we would say, in this imaginary world, we would say, there's no reason to expect that time should run the same for different journeys. Now, in a certain sense, the revolution in our understanding of time that took place at the beginning of the 20th century was the realization that this imaginary world that I've sketched for you, where the time that passes for you depends on the journey that you take, is our real and actual world. The reason that we hadn't noticed it before, we hadn't noticed our world is this strange one, and why we don't notice it in our everyday lives, is that the differences in time that pass on the different journeys we take in our everyday lives are extremely tiny. Minute fractions, billionths of seconds, too short for our crude watches and clocks to register. So we just don't notice. But it's really the case. If we had super accurate watches, accurate to billionths of a second, then we would see these differences. We would see directly that time is not universal. I want now to give you a more detailed description of this scientific development and show you that it makes this view of time very natural. I've already said that the name of the development is general relativity and that it's Einstein's theory of gravity, the best theory of gravity that we have. According to this theory, space and time are not distinct entities, but are woven together into a single unified fabric known as space-time. In the modern scientific point of view, we do not live and move about in space with a big universal clock ticking away equally and uniformly for everyone. We move instead in space-time. The proper arena for our lives and everything that happens is space-time. Space-time is a central concept for what I want to say this evening, so I'm going to describe it to you with some care. Space-time is composed of all events, where an event is a point in space at a particular moment of time. And I can mark an event by, say, snapping my fingers. So that took place at a particular point in space here, at a particular point in time, which was then, the moment that I snapped my fingers. Even when I don't snap my fingers, a point in space at a moment in time is an event and is included in space-time. Space-time has four dimensions, which sounds complicated, but all that it means is that each event needs four numbers to specify where it is. Those numbers are called coordinates, and you can think of them as, think of that event. That can be specified exactly by saying how far from the floor it was, how far from the back wall, how far from the side wall, and when in time it was. That's four numbers to tell me that where that event is. In order to get a better feeling for space-time, I've drawn a picture of a piece of a rather simple one on this transparency. Okay, that's a very simple space-time. It's a flat two-dimensional space-time. So I want you just to think of it as just a piece of paper, just something very flat, or just the surface of the screen. Think of this drawing as a map of space-time. I've drawn a border around it, not because space-time has a border or an edge, but because this is just a map of a piece of it. Just as this map is a map of Waterloo. It has a border, but we don't believe that Waterloo just ends here. We've just got a picture of part of it. So in the same way, this is just a map of a piece of space-time. This map of space-time is also highly simplified, just as the map of Waterloo is highly simplified. You know that there are many features of Waterloo that are not represented on that map, but nevertheless, it's a good map, it's useful, and we can talk about certain properties that Waterloo has, but just by looking at the map. So in the same way, this is a very simple map of a piece of space-time, and we can talk about some of the properties that space-time has just by looking at the map. So one of the simplifications that I've made is that there's no gravity in this space-time, whereas we know that there is gravity in our real space-time, in our real world. And I'll explain later what difference this makes. Another simplification that I've made is that this space-time is two-dimensional, whereas our real space-time is four-dimensional, as I said. But I can't draw four dimensions, and so the best that we can do is to investigate this simpler case and then say to ourselves, the real world is like this, only with two extra dimensions. Now, this is something that's perfectly scientific. It's not just a fudge that I'm making because this is a popular talk. I've never met a physicist who claims they can even visualize a four-dimensional space-time, let alone draw it. So think of this picture as a two-dimensional map of a piece of our space-time. And the real world just has two more dimensions that we can't draw. Remember that two-dimensional means that in order to specify where an event is in space-time, I need two coordinates. Just like I need two coordinates or map references to specify a point on the map of Waterloo. So let me just show you this. So I apologize that this is a bit fuzzy on your screens. So on the map, there are barely visible light blue grid lines running vertically and horizontally, and I've labeled them. So there's one, two, three, four grid line, five grid lines that I've labeled 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 along the bottom. And then there are horizontal grid lines that I labeled 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 6 along the side. And to specify any point on this map, all I need to give you is two numbers. So for example, the rec center is there. And it's roughly halfway between 0 and 1, so I give it the coordinate 0.5. The horizontal coordinate 0.5. And the vertical coordinate is, it's slightly above the halfway mark between 3 and 4, so 3.6 is about right. So these are the coordinates of the rec center. And any two numbers I can give you will specify a point on the map, and the other way around, give me a point on the map, and I can give you what the coordinates are. And just the same way, I can put coordinates on space-time. So here are my coordinates. So I've just drawn a grid on my space-time. I can label the grid lines as I've done. So again, 0 to 6 along the bottom, 0 to 9 along the side. And now I can specify any individual event in space-time by giving its coordinates with respect to the grid. So for example, here's an event. I've called it X. You can imagine that as something like that. There it is. And it has two coordinates, 3, 3. Those are its coordinates. In our real space-time, three of the coordinates are spatial coordinates, and one is a time coordinate. In this two-dimensional space-time, one of the coordinates only is a space coordinate, and one is a time coordinate. And it's a convention that I've never seen violated anywhere, so I'm not going to do it tonight, always to draw space-time with the time coordinate increasing as you go up the page. So you can see the time coordinate is 0 here, and it increases as you go up the page. Now, a very special property of space-time is that you can't stay still in it. Let's think about a person living in this simplified universe, this simplified space-time, who happens to be at the event X, happens to be at space position 3, at time position 3. And suppose they stay at space coordinate 3. Okay, that's fine, they can do that, they just sit still. But of course, time passes for them. Time will pass. That's the property that time has. It's inexorable. You can't sit there and say, time's not going to pass for me. It will, no matter what you do. So for this person at X, time will pass. And so their time, the time coordinate must increase. So they can stay at position X in space, but in time, time must pass. So they'll move up this line. They'll trace out in space-time what's called a world line. That's just a path through space-time. It's a nice word though, world line. So this is the world line of a person in this space-time who stays at spatial coordinate 3. Time passes, so they must move in space-time. They move in the time direction. And they sweep out this world line. All beings and objects that exist trace out a world line in space-time. So let's look at some others. This line is the world line of someone. Someone who stays at space coordinate 5. They just stay still at space coordinate 5. Again, time passes for them, and they move up this world line. Can I just check and see what you're seeing? I can barely read it. I'm sorry. It's a bit fuzzy. So what about some other world lines? Well, here are two, these green ones. This world line here is the world line of someone who starts at event X and then moves gradually over in space to the right. So their spatial coordinate is changing. So it's changing from 3 and getting bigger. It's moving to the right. And of course, time is also passing for them, so they must move up in time as well. So they're moving to the right, and time is passing. And they're moving at a constant speed. That's why this line is straight. This green line here is the world line of someone who moves to the left. So their spatial coordinate is changing. It's getting smaller from 3. It's reducing. Time is passing for them also. So this is the world line that they trace out in space-time. This blue line is the world line of someone who starts at X but moves to the right faster than the person moving on the green world line. They're moving faster, you can see, because their spatial coordinate is increasing more for the same amount of time that's passed. So for the same amount of time coordinate that changes, the blue one is further over to the right, so they're moving faster. And finally, I'll remove these ones and show you the world line of someone who's moving not with a constant speed, but with changing speed. So people and objects don't have to move on straight world lines. They can move on world lines which are curved. So the speed of this person moving through space-time is changing. And in fact, they're also changing direction. OK. Let me go back to these lines here. So everyone and everything follows a world line through space-time. But not every line in space-time is a possible world line for a person or an object. And the reason is that there's a maximum possible speed that anyone or anything can have. And that speed is the speed of light. And you can see that as these lines move away from the vertical more and more, the speed of that person is increasing. So eventually, there'll be one line which represents something moving at the speed of light. And beyond that, the trajectory becomes impossible for anyone to follow. And by convention, again, there are also conventions in relativity. By convention, the world line of something moving at the speed of light is a line that goes at exactly 45 degrees to the vertical. So it's a line that looks like this. So this black line here, starting at X, is the world line that a particle of light, called a photon, would travel, or anything else that moves at the speed of light would travel on. This is the world line of light, a light trajectory. Of course, light could also, that's the light going to the right. Light can also go to the left, from starting at x, so it could go along this world line, again, moving at 45 degrees. And because nothing can travel faster than light, the person who happens to be at x, who happens to start at x, must always, wherever they go in the future, wherever they go in space-time, they cannot go outside these, the region that's between these two black lines. So in the future, the person who happens to be at the event x must move forwards into this V-shaped region in between the two black lines. If they were to try to go here, for example, from x, to get there, they would have to go faster than the speed of light. So they can't get there. They can never reach any of the points that are beyond the two light trajectories. So that's, we've talked about what happens in the future to the person who's at x. But what about the past? How did the person at the event x get to be there? They must have gotten there from somewhere. Where could the person have come from in the past? Well, if we draw the light trajectories that end up at x, we get the following picture. So as I said before, between the two future light trajectories is the, all the places in space-time that someone starting at the event x can get to. And we call that the causal future of x. These two lines represent the trajectories of light particles that come from the past and end up at the event x. And in between those two lines is the part of space-time where the person at x must have come from. And we call that the causal past of x. Everywhere else in space-time, that is these regions here, outside the causal past and causal future, is often given the joke name of elsewhere, since it's not the past, it's not the future, it's just elsewhere. So this region of space-time, the elsewhere of x, this is the region that's not causally related to x at all. So no event here can influence anything at x, because to do so, it would have to, something would have had to travel from that event over here to x, and that would have had to have gone faster than the speed of light, and similarly from over here. So nothing here can influence x, and similarly, x cannot influence any of the points in its elsewhere. So as far as the event x is concerned, space-time is divided up into three parts. The future is the part of space-time that can be reached from x. The past is the part of space-time from which x can be reached. And the rest of space-time, this elsewhere, is not related to x in either way. It can either influence or be influenced by anything that happens at x. We say there is no causal relation between x and any event in the elsewhere region, whereas x and any event in its past or future are causally related. This so-called causal structure has the same form at every other event in space-time. I mean, I chose this event x at 3:3 completely arbitrarily. I could have chosen any other event, any other position in space-time to perform this discussion about. So for example, I could have chosen the point y at position space coordinate 4, time coordinate 5. That also has a causal future. It's this region here, in between the two light trajectories that come from y. And it has a causal past. That's the region in between the two light trajectories that end up at y. And similarly, every point in this space-time, w, z, and every other point that I haven't drawn, they also have causal pasts and causal futures. So the future, your future, my future, is personal. it depends where you are in space-time, where you're starting from in space-time, what your the future, what the, your possible potential future could be. There are some regions of space-time that you will never ever be able to get to, you can never influence. We now have a worldview of a space-time with world lines followed by all the things that exist. Looking like this. Let me get back my simple space-time. So I've just gotten rid of the grid for now. So this is my space-time with some world lines in it. You and I are following our own world lines in space-time right now. The fact that this new way of looking at our existence, the fact that makes this new way of looking at our existence relevant to the question of time is the following. There is no universal time in space-time. Instead, time is individual to each world line. The time that passes along each world line depends completely on the world line itself. And I want to illustrate this in an example. So I just put the grid lines back for now. And in my space-time, I've got four volunteers, red, green, blue, and black. And they're each equipped with a stopwatch, which they synchronize. They start off together at this event, space coordinate 2 at 0 time coordinate. So they're all together. They synchronize their stopwatches, and then they go off on four different journeys. Red just stays put in space, just stays at space coordinate 2, and time passes. They've all agreed that they're going to meet up later at a particular event which has space coordinate 2 and time coordinate 6. So they all know that that's what they've got to do. Green goes off at half the speed of light and then comes back again. Goes off to the right at half the speed of light, halfway through the journey, turns around and comes back to the left and ends up again at half the speed of light and ends up at the designated rendezvous. Blue travels to the right, but with 9/10 of the speed of light, turns around at the halfway point, comes back at 9/10 of the speed of light, and meets up with the others at the rendezvous. Black is actually a photon. So strictly, this photon can't carry a stopwatch, because a stopwatch couldn't go at the speed of light. But let's imagine that they have a stopwatch anyway. So this photon has a stopwatch, goes off at the speed of light, halfway through the journey, turns around, comes back again, and meets up with everybody else at the rendezvous point. Okay, and then they compare their stopwatches. Red stopwatch shows that 6 seconds have passed. So it's a pretty short journey for everybody. Green stopwatch shows that they've taken actually 5.2 seconds to go along their journey. So that's slightly less than six. Not much less, but slightly less. You'd think that going at half the speed of light would gain you something, but it's not that much difference. But then at 9/10 of the speed of light, then we're really seeing some changes. At 9/10 of the speed of light, the time taken along blue's world line through space-time is actually 2.6 seconds. And finally, the time shown on the hypothetical stopwatch carried by the photon is actually no time at all. So the photon, in fact, arrives, as far as it's concerned, just as soon as it leaves. Now these numbers, I haven't just conjured them up out of my head. So I did a little calculation to work out what these numbers were. And the calculation is based on the theory of general relativity. Actually, the theory of general relativity applied to this special case of a space-time where there's no gravity. And you won't be surprised to hear that that case has its own special name called special relativity. So I've used the rules of special relativity to calculate these numbers. And these numbers are the real numbers, the real amounts of time that would be measured by stopwatches if we could do such an experiment, if we could send something at half the speed of light, at 9/10 of the speed of light, and if we could, which we can't, give a photon a stopwatch. Now remember the imaginary world where how much time passes depends on where you go and what you do, and how I said that that was not imaginary at all, but our real world, and how that seemed strange. Well, once you get used to the idea, this basic idea that we trace out world lines in space-time, this idea starts to seem less strange and start to seem more natural. If two people follow different paths in space-time, why shouldn't their watches show different amounts of time to have passed? We're familiar with the idea that we can travel different routes in space between two places, and the distance that we measure along the way, say by the odometers in our car, will be different for different routes between the same two endpoints. So we can go from Waterloo to London on one set of roads and get a certain amount of certain distance. And then on a different set of roads, the odometers will measure a different distance. Well, it's a similar situation with time in space-time. Clocks are like odometers for time along routes through space-time. And there's no wonder that they show different amounts of time for different journeys, different routes through space-time. As I've said before, the reason that we don't notice such differences in the times that we measure in everyday life is that speeds at which we move are extremely tiny, too tiny, and that makes the tiny compared with the speed of light, and that makes the differences in the times too small for our watches and clocks to register. For example, if I were to go to Paris, Air Canada and back, then the difference in time that my watch would measure and the clock here in the room would measure would be some billionths of a second, far too small for us to notice. But those differences, I'd like to keep emphasizing, are real. And we have confirmed them in a multitude of different ways by now, from experiments with accurate atomic clocks flown around on airplanes to the lifetimes of cosmic ray particles traveling close to the speed of light, to the whole field of high-energy elementary particle physics. As an extreme example of this relativity of time, the fact that time is relative to individual paths through space-time, let me tell you about the age of the universe. It is often said, I've often heard it said, that the universe is about 13 billion years old. That is to say, 13 billion years have passed since the universe began in the Big Bang. Now, what does this mean? I've just told you that time is relative to the path taken through space-time. So saying that the universe is 13 billion years old really means that there is a path through space-time that begins at the Big Bang and ends at us here and now, along which the time that has passed is 13 billion years. Now, that path is the path traced out in space-time by our galaxy. This is cosmology, and cosmology is a very crude science, which is only concerned with very, very large things, and usually galaxies about the smallest entity that is ever considered by a cosmologist. So here's a picture of what I just said. Here's our universe. This time down here, this is the Big Bang. Time increases as you go up the page. That's the convention. And here is our world, the world line of our galaxy. Actually, the galaxy wasn't formed around the time of the Big Bang, so this is a bit rough here. So this is our galaxy, the world line. And let's say this red point is our galaxy now, at the present moment. Saying that the universe is 13 billion years old means that along this trajectory through space-time, a clock would have measured 13 billion years. But what about other trajectories through space-time that begin in the Big Bang? We can ask, for fun, just how old the universe is as far as other paths taken are concerned. For a neutrino that travels at 0.9999999999999 times the speed of light, only about a year has passed since the beginning of the universe. And for a photon, a particle of light created just after the Big Bang, traveling without interacting with anything through intergalactic space that just reaches us now, no time at all has passed since the Big Bang. It is as freshly minted when we receive it as the moment when it was created. Okay, what about gravity? I keep saying that general relativity is Einstein's theory of gravity, but then I showed you a space-time which had no gravity in it at all. We know that there's gravity in our real universe, in our real space-time. Would a space-time with gravity alter these conclusions that I've been telling you? Not in essence. A space-time with gravity just means a space-time that isn't flat, but is curved or warped, and it can be drawn like this. At least a two-dimensional one can be drawn like this. So this is a space-time that has gravity in it. And again, we've got spatial coordinate. Along the bottom, and a time coordinate running along the side. There are events, just as before, and for each event, we can draw the light trajectories that come out of the event, the light trajectories that go into it, and each event has a causal past and a causal future, just as before. This is the causal future of this event. This is the causal past of this event. And similarly up here, these are the light trajectories. They might be a bit curved and warped themselves. And this is the causal future of that event. This is the causal past of that event. The calculations about how much time elapses along any given world line are more complicated in general relativity than they are in special relativity when there's no gravity. In general relativity, when there is gravity, time doesn't just depend on the speed at which you're moving, but what the strength of the gravitational force is where you are. So for example, time goes faster on top of a mountain than it does at sea level. But the overall picture of space-time is the same. With or without gravity, we have a space-time, and we have world lines of all existing things traced out in space-time. And let me draw, just give you that picture again. As far as general relativity is concerned, we must think of this, the whole space-time, past and future, the whole history of the universe from its beginning, if it had a beginning, to its end, if it has an end, as real. It's a frozen block, a whole indivisible entity existing in a timeless way. And everything in space-time exists timelessly also. For example, this green line is my world line, from my birth to my death, laid out timelessly in this frozen, timeless block. Nowhere in the physical description does anything appear that could correspond to my conscious experience of the moment of now. I feel that there's this now, right? It's somewhere I was born and I'm going to die. Somewhere in the middle is now, like there. And it's constantly changing, right? So this point moves inexorably up my world line towards my death. But there's nothing, nothing at all in the theory which corresponds to that point. And the same thing is true for all of you. Each one of you has your world line from your birth to your death laid out in space-time, but nowhere in this description of space-time, nowhere in the theory, nowhere in general relativity is anything that you could point to and say, that is the moment of now, that's the moment that I experience. And this is true not just for us, but for everything that has existed in the past and that will exist in the future. General relativity denies that there is anything real about our experience of time passing, and it implies that this experience that we have must be some kind of illusion. This is extremely odd and disturbing, though not, I want to emphasize, a direct contradiction with anything that we observe or measure. If we had a contradiction, we would throw out the theory as false. And we don't have such a contradiction. We believe the theory is true. Is it really true that the passage of time is not an actual phenomenon, but just a trick that our mind is playing on us? Can we fathom this mystery? One possible attitude to it is that it's a puzzle which science will never penetrate. And that may turn out to be the case. But never is a long time, and surely it's too soon to say. Instead, I would tentatively suggest two possible lines along which an explanation might be sought, both of which require new science, and they may perhaps be related. One possibility is that a proper theory of consciousness will account for it. And since I'm not an expert on that, I'm not going to say anything more about it. The other possibility, the other line of investigation, is that known as quantum gravity. Though general relativity is our best current theory of gravity, we believe that it's only the best for now because it's not compatible with our other current best theory, quantum mechanics, that describes the matter in the universe. Quantum gravity is the name we give to the theory we're looking for that will be compatible with quantum mechanics and is more fundamental than general relativity and from which general relativity can be derived. I want to sketch for you now an approach to this 78-year-old quest that may be able to conform more closely to our intuitive ideas about time, but, and yet is compatible with everything that I've told you about general relativity, space-time, and the individual nature of time. Now, what I'll tell you is very speculative. We don't know if a theory along these lines will actually be the theory of quantum gravity, but it contains ingredients that suggest a way to restore the flow of time to physics. The approach is called causal set theory. And if it isn't as well known as it should be, maybe it's because it has not a particularly unprepossessing name. Causal set theory is based on the idea that space-time is not really smooth and continuous as it seems to us, but is fundamentally grainy or bitty. Just as ordinary matter seems smooth and solid to us, but we know if we study it in more detail, it's really composed of separate atoms. So, also, the idea goes, space-time appears smooth and continuous to us, because the spacing between the individual elements of which the space-time is composed is so tiny. Many workers in the field of quantum gravity believe that space-time is not smooth, but pixelated in this way. There are many reasons for this. Assuming that space-time is perfectly smooth means assuming that lengths can be as small as we like, and time intervals as short as we like, and still make sense. So if you take 1 centimeter, divide it by 10, and keep dividing by 10. If space-time is really smooth, then those tinier and tinier lengths all make sense. They all exist physically. Studied at these tiny scales, however, our current best theories run into problems that suggest that these length scales really don't exist. They suggest that there's, in fact, a shortest length scale, smaller than which lengths don't make sense anymore. Other motivations for believing that space-time is grainy are more philosophical. Quantum mechanics itself is named for the fact that energy does not come in arbitrary amounts, but in fixed quanta or packets. You can have 1, 2, 3 quanta, but not 1.5. We might imagine that a quantum theory of space-time might require that space-time itself is composed of indivisible quanta of space-time. And indeed, that is what causal set theory proposes. Causal set theory makes a definite proposal for how these individual space-time quanta fit together to make a space-time. So this is a picture of space-time again, two-dimensional. Well, actually, any dimensional. I'm getting more abstract now as my talk goes on. The idea behind causal set theory is that a little piece of space-time that seems perfectly smooth, if you blow it up and look at it at with a very, very, very powerful microscope, you'll see that it's not smooth at all, but is made of these individual space-time elements, or quanta, which I've represented by these black dots. How many of these elements are there? How many elements of these individual space-time atoms? I say atoms in inverted commas because I don't want you to think real atoms. They're not the same thing as real as the atoms that make up this lectern. But I call them, they can be called atoms in the sense that they're indivisible things, indivisible entities. So how many of them are there? Well, in a piece of space-time that's 1 centimeter cubed, think of a 1 centimeter cube, that sweeps out a bit of space-time for 1 second, there will be 10 to the 142 of these elements. So that's an awful lot. And the idea is that there are so many of them that we don't notice the fact that space-time is not smooth because there are just so many. At our gross scale, at our gross level of perception, we don't notice that space-time is really grainy like this. What is one of these elements like? Is it made of anything else? Well, no. So in the theory, it is structureless. It has no other feature apart from the fact that it exists. It's an indivisible element of reality, you could say. That's a bit pompous, but you could say it. It's not made of anything else. It simply is. How are these elements stuck together to make space-time? Well, that's what makes causal set theory special. It's a proposal for how these indivisible elements are stuck together. The glue that keeps them together and builds them into a space-time is their causal relations to each other. So, and I've illustrated this, sketched this by drawing on these red lines. That's what these red lines are meant to represent. So a red line between this element and this one, that means that this element is in the causal future of this element. When there's no red line between two points, that means that those two points are in the elsewhere of each other. How can a fundamental bittiness to space-time help to restore a physical flow of time? Well, to see how it can, I first need to show you what goes wrong if we try to restore a flow of time to general relativity itself. As I said, a space-time that exists past and future all at once denies our experience of a present moment. So let's just declare that only the past exists, that the future doesn't exist yet, and the present is what divides the past from the future. Let's just declare that to be so. Then there's an obvious way to make that happen in general relativity, and the obvious way is like this. Here's space-time again. Here's my world line. Of course, there are all these other world lines in as well. Here's now. Let's say there's now. Okay, now. What do I do? All right. What I do is I just block off the top of space. Oh, I'll have to draw a line here. No, that doesn't show up. Okay, sorry. On my world line that's constantly revealed, that's now. So there we are, we've got a flow of time. And then I've died, okay. The problem with that, why can't I do that? I can just do that, I can say, and there we got a flow of time. The problem with that is that I could equally well block off space-time in that way and say, this is the past that exists, and my flow of time does this. Again, there is a flow of time, it's just a different flow of time. Or I could do it this way. There's the past that exists, the future hasn't happened yet, and I'm revealing the space-time. I could do that. I could do something even fancier. I could have my division between the past and the future be all curvy and there. And as you can see, there are infinitely many ways that I can just impose this flow of time, this evolution of the universe, this growth of the universe in time on general relativity. So which one do we choose? The problem is that they're all equally wrong, because there's nothing in general relativity that has any that tells you which one of those to choose. Trying to make space-time grow in this way, trying to give it a flow of time, is something that we impose on general relativity, which has no basis in the theory itself. But suppose now that space-time is not really smooth and continuous, but it is pixelated. It's made out of individual elements packed tightly together. Now we have an option that wasn't available to us in general relativity. And this is the option. This is a part of space-time. This is the past. And at some stage in the growth of the universe, this is what the universe looks like. So all of these are individual space-time elements, these grains of space-time, and they're glued together with their causal relations in this way. And that's what the universe looks like at some stage. Then, a new element is born. It just pops into existence. And it attaches itself somewhere to the space-time elements that already exist. Now, where does it attach itself? Well, it attaches itself at random somewhere. And the randomness is a new law of nature. It's a new rule, a new probabilistic rule for attaching a new space-time element to the ones that already exist. What is that rule? Well, I can't tell you what that is, because that is the theory of quantum gravity that we are seeking. But we know, because quantum theory itself is a probabilistic theory, it has a fundamental randomness, that this theory of attaching a new element to the already existing elements of space-time will be a random law. So we get the following picture. Space-time grows element by element, and the elements accrete onto the elements that already exist. The elements that already exist are the past. There's a future which is open. It hasn't happened yet. The future is all the elements in the that will, later on, be born and attach themselves to the past. At any particular stage in the growth process, space-time looks like this. And there's a past, which is the elements that have already occurred. There's a future, which is nothing. The future is open in just the way that we intuitively feel should be. And the present, you could think of as that boundary in between the two. I don't claim that such a theory, should it turn out to be correct as a theory of quantum gravity, would explain why we experience the passage of time. But it would coincide with the overwhelming sense that we have that the past is fixed, the future open, and the present is what divides them. Moreover, I find there is a resonance with some of the strongest emotions that we can experience as human beings. When someone beloved dies, those who still live feel terrible grief and loss and longing. But often, and sometimes only after a very long period of mourning, we can come to feel that the beloved is still real. And this view of space-time, this view of quantum gravity that I've sketched for you, accords with this. The events of the beloved's life, their words and actions, are real. They're real, embedded in a really existing space-time past. They're real, and as real as anything that exists now. So I'll just summarize. I've described how general relativity brings with it a worldview in which the arena in which we live out our lives is space-time. We and everything else in the universe trace out world lines along which the amount of time that passes depends on the world line itself. So time is individual to world lines and not universal. This viewpoint includes the view that the whole infinite history of the universe, past, future, past and future, is real, and there seems to be no place in it for the special moment of our present experience. I then sketched very briefly and very heuristically a particular approach to quantum gravity called causal set theory, in which space-time is grainy and not smooth. And I argued that it may be able to conform more closely to our deep sense of the reality of the passage of time. Thank you.
So if there are any questions, we have John over there with the microphone, and I guess Richard over here with the microphone. Just put up your hand and they'll come to you.
I'm reminded by your talk for some reason of Dan Quayle's famous remark that the future will be different tomorrow. But I would like to know, in the theories you sketched out, if there is any room for time travel. I'm a science fiction fan. So. Uh-huh.
So I have bad news for you. So if causal set theory is along the right lines, then it rules out time travel into the past. So time travel into the future, of course, we can always achieve. And in fact, let me show you this. Thing again. If we could go arbitrarily fast, as close to the speed of light as we like, then we can go as far into the future as we want to. So if we traveled at or very, very, very close to the speed of light, to the distant reaches of the observable universe and back, then billions of years would pass while we were away. But for us, we'd be there and back in a blink of an eye. So that kind of time travel, we already know we can do. But causal set theory, I'm afraid, would rule out time travel into the past.
You have up there four colored lines showing different speeds. And having them come back to the same set point, 6-2.
Yep.
Why do that rather than have them end up at a different point after the same length of time in a space-time universe?
Because there's no such thing as the same length of time. In order to determine whether there are differences in the amount of time that passes on different trajectories, they have to come back to the same point to compare their watches. If they're in different places, they'll never know. They can't know what the time that passed for the other person was.
Well, do they know that all four are at 6-2, or are they at... They're standing in the same space, okay. But are they standing in the same space-time?
So this is obviously, it's simplification. So they can be very, very close to each other. Obviously, they can't be right in the same on the same space-time event, because they'd be superimposed on each other. So they're very close to each other. So I've fudged that a little bit and shown them exactly at the starting at exactly the same event and ending at exactly the same event. That in reality they would be, if they were real volunteers, then they would start just very close to each other. You choose. Okay. All right.
Thank you. I recall a lecture a little while ago that I heard a gentleman talking about the Big Bang theory, and as I understood it, which is a whole other lecture itself, he explained to me and the audience that they could get back theoretically back to 10 to the, I believe it was minus 32nd of a second. Now, is there any indication that that may be the length of one of these quantum time particles, or one of these indivisible time particles, if I can use that that term?
That does sound like what people call the Planck time. That's roughly 10 to the minus, well, that's roughly 10 to the minus 43 seconds, actually. So what was that one? 10 to the minus 30?
32.
Yeah, I don't know. So 10 to the minus 43 seconds, that is the so-called Planck time. And the connection between the sort of the scale of this graininess, so the scale of the graininess of space-time and the Planck time, it's actually, it's very subtle. So in fact, the graininess is not a graininess that you can measure in divisions of time, or in fact even in divisions of length. So the Planck length is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. But it's a graininess that's measured on a scale of volume. So I said space-time has four dimensions. So there are three dimensions of space and one of time. So if you multiply three Planck lengths by one Planck time, you get a so-called Planck volume. And you can think of each of these space-time elements as occupying a single Planck volume. So there is a connection, but it's sort of a little bit more involved than just the time, just the Planck time.
I have a question. There's a book, The End of Time, by Julian Barber. What's your relationship to that book? And I don't understand that book, so.
Well, Julian Barber is a good friend of mine, and I've had the pleasure of many discussions on the subject of time with him. So I don't know if the other members of the audience have heard about this book. Julian Barber is a physicist who strongly believes that his view, I would say, is virtually orthogonal to everything that I've said tonight. So he very strongly disbelieves in space-time, and he seems to believe very strongly in space only. He believes there's no time, no space-time, but just space. And I disagree. I mean, he and I just have a fundamental disagreement on that point. So that's. Oh.
You were mentioning in your one cubic centimeter over 1 second.
Yes.
The number of elements were 10 to 142. How did you come up with that number?
Well, that was related to this gentleman's question about the Planck time and the Planck length. So very general arguments seem to suggest that lengths shorter than this Planck length, which are 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, don't make sense physically. And similarly, time intervals shorter than the so-called Planck time, which is the time that light would take to travel a Planck length, that's the relationship between the two. So times shorter than the Planck time also don't make sense. So if you measure how many Planck length cubed times Planck time, Planck length cubed times Planck times fit into a centimeter cubed times a second, then it's 10 to the 142. That's the relationship.
Yeah, you have mentioned Newtonian physics and relativity, both of which treat past and future symmetrically. But thermodynamics and the concept of entropy is a little bit different, because entropy is always increasing and it is one-dimensional. Is there any relationship between the increase in entropy and the flow of time?
No, I think that these are separate. I mean, the question of how entropy is related to the arrow of time it's a question at a higher or at a different level from this question. So this question is whether we can restore a flow of time whilst keeping the fundamentals of general relativity intact. So whether by including quantum concepts we can keep the principles of general relativity and space-time, the structure of space-time, intact, and yet still have a physical phenomenon which is the flow of time. So I think that's a different question to the arrow of time, which I think is what you're alluding to with your question about entropy. Did that answer your question? Is that?
Yeah. What I'm wondering is that we have a subjective sense of the time moving on or time flowing, and whereas in Newtonian physics or in relativity, we cannot differentiate between past and future. But according to entropy, there is basically a difference between past and future because entropy is going in one direction. The entropy is increasing in one direction. So, yeah, I mean, it is a little bit different from your research here, or the focus of your research, but you know, like people have talked about that it is related to the flow of time somehow.
Well, I think the arrow of time is slightly different from having a flow of time at all. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, why would it be necessary for you to posit that the past exists? In other words, when we make experiments and draw conclusions about things that have happened, the information, the inferences that we make, etc., they all exist in the present. And you presented the relativity theory as saying that the past and the present are one thing, and then in your theory now you've blanked out the future, as it were, but you want to claim that the past actually has an existence.
Yes.
Well, isn't that your need to restore the flow of time leads you to posit the existence of this past? Couldn't you just say that the only thing that really exists is the present? Why would you have to claim that the past actually exists, whatever that would mean? Because isn't it just enough to say that the only thing that exists is the present? Because after all, everything that we know or even guess about the past is just an image in our mind of that exists in the present.
So the reason that I can't, and I don't think it could possibly be compatible, the reason that I don't think it could make sense to say only the present exists in a way that's compatible with general relativity is that the present can never be defined in a way that's objective. So it's always a matter of subjective choice what you choose to be the present. So in my picture, like this, I could choose the present to be this, or I could choose it to be that, so the present, you want it to be the present not just for you, but for everything that exists. That's generally that's what we mean when we say the present moment. But in general relativity, that has no objective independent meaning. It could be, I could draw this line through space-time and call that the present. So it can't be the thing that the present can't be the thing that exists if the principles of general relativity are to be maintained. They may not be. It may be that general relativity will be overthrown by a theory which is very different, in which some of the basic principles are actually broken, and then we would have some other theory along some different, and the development of science would go along a different direction to the one that I've sketched here. So it might be that there is an objectively definable universal present moment, for everything in the universe. But if general relativity, if the basic ideas of general relativity are to be held onto, then that can't be so.
Hi, thanks for a wonderful lecture. I just, one last question, wanted to say, I think your theory is brilliant, and I think this science of time is probably going to bring us into the realm of, as we cut magnets and we look under microscopes, we'll probably find that, although it appears to be a constantly occurring positive and negative, we'll probably catch that crest of time and see that there is, in fact, a monopole in the electromagnetics, and perhaps it will, the quantum gravity and the monopole of electromagnetics will bring us to a new level of understanding. I wondered if you've ever considered that as far as beyond quantum gravity, but in conjunction with the electromagnetics to come up with the grand unified.
You've covered everything there. I couldn't possibly follow up that.
I just wondered if your statement about the theory of consciousness as an explanation had anything to do with the difficulty of describing what stops at death in space-time. Like, time doesn't stop and space doesn't stop, but, or space is fixed, but.
I wanted to avoid talking about a theory of consciousness altogether, since.
What stops at death, I guess, is the basic question in space-time. Is it?
Well, as far as space-time is concerned, nothing stops at death. I mean, it just carries on physically as it does, so.
Am I? Yes. And with that unfortunately impersonal view of our insignificance in the universe, I think it's time to wrap up. I would like to once again thank Dr. Dauker for a wonderful lecture. Thank you very much, Dr. Dauker. I would also like to point out the people who have been helping all along with these lectures. So John McCormick with the microphone, Richard Epp at the microphone, Sheena Gilkes, who arranged the entire venture, Karen Wiatowski, Sue Scanlon, and other people from the Institute who have, Rob Johnston, who have very graciously donated their time to make this happen, time and time and time again. I'd like to remind all of you that on November 5th, there'll be a panel discussion, as I said before, and I hope to see you all again then. Thank you very much. Have a pleasant evening. Good night.